think the core thing I got from mathematics, which then I brought to philosophy also, was that when we look for the truth, we're like archaeologists. We're uncovering something that's already been laid out before us and trying to make sure we don't damage it or misinterpret it as we pick it up. We're not architects who get to build things to suit ourselves. Everything we receive is a gift.
Hello, and thanks for joining in. I'm Jana Harmon, and you're listening to Side B Stories, where we see how skeptics flip the record of their lives. Each podcast, we listen to someone who has once been an atheist who became a Christian against all odds. You can also hear today's story, along with other short video testimonies from former atheists, on our Side B Stories website. Oftentimes, we think that atheists have nothing in common with those who believe in God, but that's not necessarily true. Both points of view can equally acknowledge the existence of certain parts of reality, but they have different explanations about what something is and how it came to be. One of those hot topics of debates between atheists and Christians is something we all have a very deep intuition about. That there are certain things or actions in our world that are really right or really wrong, not merely for ourselves, but for everyone. As C.S. Lewis says, if someone cuts in line, we automatically think that's unfair according to some commonly understood rule or standard of fairness. And that's certainly the case for much more serious points of injustice. It doesn't take a lot of time to consider whether or not certain things are more like vices or virtues. In our own minds, we are constantly making judgments about whether or not something or another should or should not be the case, whether or not someone ought or ought not to do something. We simply can't help ourselves in the way that we are constantly judging. The problem is not that we can't or don't know what's right or wrong. The problem isn't even that we aren't capable of living good lives with or without God. The problem is rather where we ground those moral duties and obligations as true and real, not merely opinion or preference. From an atheist household, Leah Labresco learned to critically analyze ideas from a very early age, fostered into her Ivy League education and beyond. Her intellect drove her to deeply consider the seeming difficulty that lie with the problem of objective morality. It led her to reconsider God. Let's listen to her story. Welcome to the Side B Stories podcast, Leah. It's so great to have you with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Leah, so the audience knows who you are, a little bit about you, your education. Why don't you give us an idea of where you live? Are you married? Do you have children? Any of that?
I grew up in New York. I went to Yale University where I studied political science. And now I live in Northern Virginia with my husband and our two daughters.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. So let's start back. You said that you were born or grew up in Long Island. Is that right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you're from the big city. So why don't you walk us back to the early part of your life and growing up? Tell me about your family, about your culture. Was God any part of that picture at all?
I'm right about 40 minutes by train outside the big city. So growing up, you know, that was definitely a big part of my life. I'd go to the Museum of Natural History for my birthday almost every year. But my family wasn't religious, and I grew up in a community that was mostly non-religious. I think there probably were some people of faith in the surrounding community, but not in a way I noticed. I didn't know anyone who believed in God personally that I knew of.
So it just wasn't part of your world at all?
It was part of my world in that I knew there were people who were Christians in the world, but not knowing any personally, that meant Christianity was mostly relevant to my life when it made the news, and that was usually in a bad way.
Yes. That seems to happen a lot where Christianity gets a very uniquely distorted picture from from the news and from the arts many times. And it sounds like you grew up in a very culturally enriched environment, but also heard, obviously, things from the news and that sort of thing about faith or Christians or Christianity. Did you say that you were raised a secular Jew?
My family is Jewish in our background, but it's long enough since anyone practiced, you know, that we don't remember the last person to practice. So, you know, my family was Jewish by heritage, but not particularly in practice in any way.
Okay, so it was more of a cultural or ethnic affiliation, but you didn't practice the High Holy Days or
no, the closest we got is that we watched the Sherry Lewis Hanukkah on TV, which I assumed everyone watched growing up, but I have the impression that may not be true.
Okay, so growing up in this environment, you had religion, I guess, as part of the cultural background, and you had bits and pieces of religion in your culture, I guess, with regard to just what happened in the city or in your environment. What did you think religion was growing up? Was obviously it wasn't for you or for your family. What was it in your mind?
I thought it was a mistake. You know, I thought it was a mistake people held on to for a long time. In the same way you can have, you know, a theory of disease or a theory of physics that's outmoded, but it takes a while for people to be comfortable with the truth that we understand better. You know, even in what you'd think of as a hard science like astrophysics, you know, there will be a long transition where people who are very invested in an old model of the world don't find a new model satisfying. And that's kind of what I thought Christians were, people who had a false model of the world and who are having trouble adjusting to a true, newer model.
So it was an outmoded way of thinking about reality, about the world. Is that something that was informed not only by your family, but by your education as well? Were you interested in the world of ideas?
Absolutely.
What shaped your thinking about all of that?
Well, I was a teenager during kind of the heyday of the new atheists, of people like Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, etc. And I think a lot of the way they wrote was really focused on the threat of religion, you know, the sense that religion wasn't just wrong in a passive, ignorable way, but it changed people's lives for the worse. It kind of focused on flashpoints of conflict, you know, teaching evolution in public schools in some parts of the country. And you know, that made it feel more urgent as an error to correct than just a different mistake people might make.
That's an interesting way of looking at it, because certainly the new atheists were very strong in their rhetoric against religion, that it was a poisonous thing that needed to be extricated from society. You know, that it was not good for, I guess, mankind or for the world. And did you affiliate, or I mean, not basically with their ideas? Did you believe in the way that they believed, in this anti-theist kind of way?
I definitely did. And I will say they pay religion a kind of compliment that people who don't believe but are willing just to tolerate it don't, which is that they think religion makes serious claims that matter, that change your life. And if the, you know, undergirding logic for those claims isn't true, then those, you know, ways you'd change your life don't work. And in some ways, I find that now as a Christian, still more respectful than just saying, as someone did to me after I converted, well, you know, whatever makes you happy. And I said, I don't care what makes me happy. I care what's true, you know, and I would hope that as my friend, you care about that for me also.
Right. So truth was important for you, even as someone who, especially as someone who was intellectually minded, who pursued not only your education in a serious way, but truth was very important to your life and the way you thought about things. Why don't you talk with me a little bit about that, especially as you're moving in towards higher education and how you made sense of reality in a sense. We all want to make sense of reality intellectually, existentially. We want to embrace a worldview that makes sense of our worldview and of our world. in a comprehensive way that matches with, you know, what we know and experience. And you are a very thoughtful, kind of brilliant mind, I think, that was who was pursuing those kinds of things. So tell us a little bit about that. Walk us through who you were more intellectually.
Well, it's funny because in some ways, you know, looking back, I see the movements of the Holy Spirit in things like my math classes, because math was a place where I was really getting to dig deeply into hard questions about what's real, what's at the bedrock of what's real. That's not always how math is taught, which is a shame because math is a philosophical proposition as well as a set of formulas. It's claims about how do we know what's true? How can we best explore it? And I loved that. It felt urgent and exciting and beautiful and difficult. Mm-hmm. And it had that sense that it does take work. You know, these questions aren't easy to answer, but you can be part of a tradition that's exploring them. You can have a shared set of tools, a shared way of deciding, you know, these are our axioms. Here's how we can extend from them to figure out the next true thing we can uncover. I think the core thing I got from mathematics, which then I brought to philosophy also, was that when we look for the truth, we're like archaeologists. We're uncovering something that's already been laid out before us and trying to make sure we don't damage it or misinterpret it as we pick it up. We're not architects who get to build things to suit ourselves. Everything we receive is a gift.
So you were not necessarily of the postmodern ilk of creating your own truth or believing in relative truth, as it were, but rather you were discovering truth, like in mathematics, that it was something to be found and not something to be created. That is a very, I would say, intellectually honest pursuit towards truth, and really, in a sense, almost countercultural to what was happening in the postmodern world. But you speak of things like math, which was a little bit more, I guess, objective in its nature. But I'm curious too, as you're moving along, and you, I presume that you identified as an atheist. Is that right?
Or absolutely.
In your atheism, as someone who pursues truth, a pursuer of truth, did you look at the existential or even intellectual implications of your own worldview as you were pursuing these kind of grander and almost abstract concepts in philosophy and in math? What about the existential implications of atheism and naturalism or materialism or whatever worldview you embraced?
Well, this is where I found parts of the new atheist movement a little dissatisfying, because I'd say that a lot of the people participating in it, in good faith, were focused primarily on shoring up defenses against religion or on arguing people out of religion. I think that came from a feeling of being very embattled in America, that people felt so under threat as atheists that there is no room for what you might think of as the luxury of expanding their own philosophy, articulating their own view. It was just about clearing space. But I felt we had some space, and that if you were going to try to argue people out of religion, you had to argue them into something else. You know, being an atheist wasn't my philosophical identity, because you can't simply not believe in something as your creed. You know, what I was initially was someone who was a deontologist stoic. I was interested in an articulation of moral law that was really rules-based rather than outcome-based. What's the right thing to do no matter what happens? And I cared a lot about what's in my control. How do I not become attached to things that aren't in my control and focus all my efforts on where I can make a difference? And so what was frustrating for me about the broader atheist movement is it didn't seem interested enough in what I thought was the really fascinating question. I thought religion was a boring question. So I wanted more space to argue about how should we live our lives? Where do we acquire our sense of the good? How do we fight each other about where those senses differ so that we can uncover the truth collaboratively, if pugilistically?
Did you ever see any religious people engaging in a deep way in those kinds of discussions? Or did you think that if you've got bits and pieces of religion based upon political or perhaps provocative statements are caricaturing in the wider culture, what did you think of Christians? And again, were they engaging in these kinds of deep discussions?
Well, this is where I really lucked out, because when I went to Yale, I joined a political debating group that wasn't kind of what you might think of as a debate team, where you're assigned sides at random and you're kind of seeing how well you can argue for any given idea. This was a philosophical debating circle where people were arguing only for what they actually believed, because the goal was to change people's minds. And it would be terrible to argue so well for something you thought was false that you changed someone's mind to that.
Yes.
And so that was where I was meeting really interesting, smart Christians who, you know, obviously didn't believe their faith just out of an obligation to their parents or unaware of questions people might ask about it. You know, some of them were also converts who had considered it and then cleaved to it. And I was given such a gift in spending every Thursday night and every Tuesday night, we met twice a week, arguing till late in the night about any kind of philosophical or ethical question, and seeing how people thought about it and what undergirded their philosophy.
I'd like to pause for a moment and tell you about our new Side B Stories website. Perhaps you or someone you know is questioning whether or not belief in God is even possible or credible, whether or not Christianity is worthy of belief. The trouble is, in our culture today, Christianity is viewed largely as a belief system for the weak, delusional, and uneducated. It can be extremely difficult to break through the negativity and stereotypes to explore authentic, historic Christianity. If you're a skeptic or atheist, what would it take for you to consider the reality of God or the truth of Christianity? Or if you're a Christian, how can you better understand or engage with skeptics in a meaningful way? Our new Side B Stories website was created with you in mind. In addition to housing our podcast stories, it also features short video testimonies from former atheists and resources they have recommended or written about their own journeys to belief. And you'll hear their advice to skeptics on how to pursue a search for God, and advice to Christians on how to engage with those who don't believe. We offer these stories from former skeptics on the Side B Stories website because there is no bigger question that affects your life than whether or not God is real or true, good or relevant. In a culture where Christianity is sometimes viewed unworthy of belief, Side B Stories shows what it did and does take for skeptics to become believers. You can find all of this by going to our new website, sidebstories.com. We hope you'll take a look and share this wonderful resource with skeptics and Christians alike. Now back to our story. So were you surprised that there were serious-minded Christians who actually thought deeply about these things? Because I know, again, there's oftentimes a negative stereotyping or caricaturing of who Christians are. And I wonder if any of those negative stereotypes were broken down by actually meeting someone who was so other than what you expected.
I was surprised. And I also had the benefit of learning the gap between what my Christian friends actually believed and some of the lowest common denominator rebuttals to Christianity that were prevalent among new atheists. You know, there were ways in which, as I talked to friends, especially Catholic friends, about, well, how do you sort out if everyone has different interpretations of the Bible? You know, how do you have any trust that you're right? What they articulated about the magisterium and tradition sounded more like what I was used to in mathematics. You know, we have a long history of how we interpret this. We have processes for adjudicating what's right. You know, figuring out something new if someone poses a new question takes a while because we're cautious about what we articulate as true, because we have this deposit of faith that's our duty to safeguard, not just kind of spout off about.
So obviously, you were able to appreciate, I guess, with this meaningful debate, that the history of Christianity or belief in God has some substance and some longevity and some, I guess, long intentionality, that these concepts and ideas have been discussed and thought about for a long time. Now, of course, that in and of itself doesn't make it true. And you are a truth seeker. So I'm curious, as you were going through these debates on Thursday nights, was it making you question your own view of reality or truth, or was it opening you towards some potential other explanations of reality?
I think one of the things that really changed for me is I didn't think Christianity was self-refuting, which is what I would have said, that the claims were incoherent, they didn't hold together, you know, that you had to ignore big gaps to remain a Christian if you looked at it. And instead, I didn't think it was true, but gradually, especially through reading C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton, who both made a big difference to me, you know, I thought of it as something that held together from the inside that I thought still was false. But it's the difference almost between a well-written fantasy or sci-fi book where you could imagine that that whole world works. It isn't true. It isn't where we live. We're not in this intergalactic civilization, but it feels real versus the ones that kind of feel thin, that the author didn't think it all the way through. You know, you can't imagine the story could continue outside the confines of the book because it isn't well thought through. It isn't a full, rich world. And Christianity shifted for me from being one of those kind of schlocky books to being something that, you know, could work if it were true. And there were even parts I found attractive about it, but I didn't think it was true. And I could never believe in something, kind of no matter how well constructed, if it wasn't founded on truth. And meanwhile, my own atheism, as I explored it, as I tussled with my friends, it had gaps. It had questions it didn't answer well. But there was nothing in it I thought was false. So I kind of had the juxtaposition of what you almost might think of as a beautiful, you know, filigree clock, you know, all put together very well with centuries of labor to see how you can get the pieces to intermesh, that wasn't on, that wasn't running, that wasn't true, animated by something true. And that was Catholicism. And then on the other hand, I had this patchwork sail with big rents in it and ugly seams. And that was my atheism, but there was nothing in it I didn't believe. And I figured I had a great deal of the rest of my life to try and make sure I kept working on it and filled in the gaps.
Now, this patchwork sail, you said that there were some rented areas, I guess you could say, of fabric that were a little bit more difficult to take or really, I guess, understand, or unanswered questions. That were there any that were so unsettling that it caused you to look beyond atheism? I mean, at the time, it sounds like you really believed that it was true. It just wasn't perhaps as comprehensive of an explanation as you wanted. What were the tears in the fabric for you?
I think one of the unsettling things was when I moved beyond what I said, deontology was where I started, a sense of what are the rules, how do you derive these rules, and, you know, a certain belief you can derive them logically, you can follow something like the categorical imperative, whatever I do has to be something I could will for everyone to do, it can't be a special rule just for me. But I found that that wasn't as satisfying as I wanted, in part because I realized, and this is partly my own faults and my own sinfulness at the time, because I cared so much about doing the right thing, especially when it was hardest, I found that I was sort of rooting for other people to be bad so that I could be best. Because there doesn't feel like there's as much virtue in being kind to someone who's kind to you. It feels more satisfying to go, I'm extremely kind to someone who is unpleasant to me. And so I wanted to be able to distinguish my virtue in a way that I realized didn't work according to the very standards that I cared about of universalizing things, of not treating myself as a special moral actor. And I wound up more and more attracted to the claims of virtue ethics, which instead of kind of starting from a rule book and just how well can I follow the rules, says, how well can I become the person I am meant to be? It's a teleological view. It's aimed at something. It doesn't require that morality is something that's so hard, but we do it anyway. It says, in some sense, this is what I'm made for. And I read a book, After Virtue, by Alistair MacIntyre, that was kind of making this case. It was very moving. I was so excited. I took it at the time to the Catholic friend I was most often talking about these questions with. And I said, well, this is what I believe. You know, this is what I want to work on as an atheist. And he said, well, you know, MacIntyre became Catholic, right? He didn't find that this worked. And I was so mad at MacIntyre specifically, for giving up. And I was like, well, I'm not going to wuss out like MacIntyre did. I'm going to keep developing this theory of virtue ethics as an atheist. But of course, you know where this ended up for me also.
So how far along did you go along that trail of really trying to, I guess, kick against the goads, as it were? It strikes me funny too. You speak of, especially in your deontology, that it didn't feel good to be kind to someone who was just kind to you, that you wanted to be able to love your enemies or something to that effect. I wondered if Jesus's ethics even came into that, somewhere along the way. It's like, wow, it sounds like your desires were something along the lines of the difficult ethics of Jesus.
I think you're giving me too much credit, though, because of course, when you love your enemy for their sake, or even for God's sake, for loving them the way God loves them. But I wanted to love them kind of in a sense of, and then I will be so strong. It's almost virtuous bench pressing, right? Like loving my enemies is bench pressing 500 pounds, and I want to do that. Right. I don't just want to love nice people, so it's just the bar empty.
Right, right. So again, so you were frustrated that that MacIntyre actually relented in some way, that he betrayed you in some way, and became a Catholic, a believer in God. So then you wanted to become this stalwart defender of virtue ethics. So where did that take you?
Well, so ultimately it took me to what felt like not a dead end, but a wall I couldn't see my way past, something I had to build something new or uncover something new to get over. And that problem was that if virtue ethics is teleological, if it's aimed at something, the question is, where do I get the sense of who I'm meant to be? This sense of the final end of man. That's a different way of framing morality than just, let me think logically about what's fair to everyone. And that was where I got stuck, because it felt like morality was a lot like math, which is how I'd felt the whole time in some way. It was real. It was separate from me. It was transcendent. And the question was, how do I come to have knowledge of it? For math, I didn't think it was that weird. You'll find people who disagree, but I found the old kind of Plato explanation pretty satisfying. I can look around the world. I can see my two hands. I can see, my two shoes and go, well, my hands and my shoes are of different types, but there's something that's the same about them. And it's that there's two of each of them. There's some separate thing that they participate in. And it's bigger than them. It's the concept of two itself. And I found this satisfying for math. And you can kind of sneak your way that way into getting the natural numbers. And then if you have the natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, etc., you can get to basically anywhere else in math from there. It just takes a really long time. But it felt like there was a foundation for these things are different than the physical world. I can see them in the physical world, but they're more than just that. And when it came to morality, I didn't have a good way to get there. I thought I can claim that I'm doing it the same way. I can say, well, I see someone defrauding an old woman and I see someone kicking a puppy. And I go, how are these things alike? They both participate in the form of injustice. And I think they do, but I don't think that's how I work it out. And I couldn't say with a straight face that was how. The numbers are a lot more obvious than injustice. It didn't feel like I worked it out by comparing how are these things similar. It felt like I already knew something about injustice and recognized it in each of them. And so the problem was, how do I know? How do I, someone who's not transcendent, come to have knowledge of the transcendent?
So that was a conundrum for you, a turning point or a pivoting because when you're dealing with these transcendental concepts and realities, like you say, that's one thing. And as you're speaking to, I'm also thinking the teleological nature, even of virtue ethics, it's going somewhere. And that also is a transcendently grounded kind of concept, even rather than things just are.
Exactly.
There's an oughtness. There's a way things ought to be, and that's how we know how to go from A to B, or that we're getting better in a sense, or progressing. So I can see from an atheistic perspective your worldview breaking down. Somehow these tears and rents are getting larger and more difficult for you. So was this a turning point then at which you said, okay, there has to be a transcendent source. There has to be something more, someone more.
Well, it's kind of funny because it was this was the thing that made a turning point possible, but that was kind of a simmering problem. I thought, I'll just keep reading. I'll keep discussing. I'll see what I can do with this. And then the bigger moment that this was laying the groundwork for kind of came when I was back at college after I'd graduated for an alumni debate. And I just had such a strange feeling while I was there. We weren't debating a topic related specifically to religion, but I could tell that I sounded like the Catholics, even though they were on different sides of the resolution. It wasn't that they all believed the same thing. It was a topic like resolve, nationalize the curriculum. It was something that's prudential. People can be on different sides. But what they were appealing to and the way they reasoned all sounded similar. They were part of one conversation. And so was I, which was weird. And I could tell kind of if you came into the room and didn't know anything about religion, but you were just trying to group people in the room based on who sounds like they agree on the fundamentals here, that I was with them. And this bothered me.
So after the debate,
it kind of kept bothering me. And we were having a toasting session where we make toasts, we pass around a big cup. And I just had the impulse that I should toast the Nicene Creed and become Catholic. And that didn't really make any sense to me. And I thought out, well, that's crazy because first of all, I don't think I know the whole Nicene Creed by heart. Second of all, I think toasting the Nicene Creed at a debate event is actually not how you become Catholic. Of course, you go through a process of RCIA. And if I were going to become Catholic, I should do it in a Catholic way, not in a weird debate culture way. And third, I don't believe in God. And come to think of it, three should have really been one. I don't know what that was doing as last on my list. And that night, I just, I gave some other cop-out toast. I was just troubled by this. And what was worst is 3 months later, I came back for another alumni debate. We have them a lot because we're all weirdos. And the same thing was happening to me during the debate, that same feeling of which side I was on. So I skipped toasting. I didn't want to go to toasting because I thought I don't want the same stupid problem again. And I grabbed a friend of mine who was Lutheran, but who I knew wanted to be a priest after he graduated. And I thought, if he wants to be a priest, then Ben can also skip toasting and come talk to me. And so I kind of laid out for him what I've been talking to you about, this problem of I'm more certain that morality is transcendent. I'm not willing to let go of that, but I can't articulate how I come to have knowledge of it. And that's where I'm stuck.
I'd like to pause for a moment and tell you about the C.S. Lewis Institute. We are living in a day and time when Christianity is being increasingly marginalized and even canceled, when distractions are prevalent, and intentionality towards spiritual growth is curbed. More than ever, we are in need of deeper intentional discipleship as we face challenges in today's world. The C.S. Lewis Institute is here to serve you, your study groups, and your church in creating mature disciples who know and live out their biblically grounded faith in Jesus Christ. They provide thoughtful, intelligent resources for individuals, groups, and Bible studies. They provide a year-long fellows program for spiritual growth among like-minded Christians pursuing faith in a serious, structured way. And they host events with respected Christian authors and thinkers to help us understand Scripture and the Christian worldview. They also help us engage culture in effective ways. We hope you'll not only take a look at these offerings, but also prayerfully consider donating to this ministry. You can find out more about the C.S. Lewis Institute and give by going to our website at www.cslewisinstitute.org. Now back to our story. And so did he, through your conversation, help you resolve this or come to a place of awareness or decision?
Well, what was great is that, you know, I've been talking through what I talked through with you, that sense of, well, I have this feeling about how this can work for math and not about how it works for ethics. And Ben said, finally, well, you've kind of gone over with me what doesn't work for you, but that doesn't feel like there's any point in wallowing in that or continuing to explore it. No matter what, you need to think of something new. So if it's not that kind of platonic ladder building up, what do you want to think about next? And I'd spent so much time kind of working the problem over and over in the same place, that kind of that space of freedom to just think of something else. I said, without really thinking about it, I guess morality just loves me or something.
That's an unusual statement.
It is. And, you know, Ben looked pretty pleased when I said it, but I really needed a second then to sit with it. I'd said it, but did I believe it? And the more I sat with it, the more I did. That if there's something I have that I can't reach myself, then I can't give up the truth that I hold it. The question is, how do I have it? If I can't build something up, then it must have come down to me. Mm. And once I'm talking about morality that way, I can't be talking about some kind of inert rule book, because a rule book doesn't move, right? I'm talking about the form of the good, no longer just as a static form, but as an agent, something that acts. And so once I'm talking about goodness itself, that in some sense is a being that acts, that not just acts or moves, but loves, you know, that does this for me, I could recognize who I was talking about, you know, goodness itself lowering himself to take the form of the slave for my sake, personally, for yours, personally. I knew I was talking about God, and not in some broad encyclopedia entry of God, but I was talking about the incarnation.
Well, that's a tremendous shift. I mean, that realization that morality loves, I mean, that... Yeah, I would say that was a major shift in your understanding and even acceptance of that new way of really looking at the source of morality itself. So I presume that was a turning point for you.
It was, you know, the next morning was the first time I ever went to church as someone who believed it was true. I'd gone with friends in college, you know, so I wasn't unfamiliar with it, but that night with Ben was the night before Palm Sunday. And so then I went to church the next day, you know, believing that it was God there on the altar, that we were talking about historical truths of what had happened in the entrance into Jerusalem, you know, and then what happened after that, you know, that was kind of the conversion of heart of coming to believe that God was. But the preparation to enter the church and kind of the constant conversion that makes up anyone's life is now not just believing that God is, but knowing him, spending time with him, developing a friendship with him, you know, in a way that even I, as a big math enthusiast, can't say that I have a personal relationship with the Pythagorean theorem. That was really a big shift also from, as an atheist, wrestling with the question of God as an intellectual proposition versus, once that had been settled, coming to know him.
So as a truth seeker, you not only pursued truth as a proposition, but truth as a person. Now it sounds like, but now you've somehow embraced a story, which some, I guess, atheists would say, well, it's still not real and it's still not true. But for you, it sounds like it is, that it is the true story of reality. Well, is that what I'm hearing from you?
Except that I would never say for me it's true. You know, what's true is true for everyone. What changed wasn't what was true for me, but what I understood about the world. But everything that's true is already true. It's just a question of whether I know about it yet.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, this has been a very insightful conversation. I think your conversion from atheism to Christianity is obviously very intellectual, but it's also very, very personal. As we're wrapping up, because it sounds like you've had a tremendous life change, but that there are also very skeptical, intellectual atheists who are listening to this podcast. If you had something to say to them in terms of their own pursuit of what is true, what words would you have to offer for them?
I think the encouraging thing is it's always worth pursuing what's true, and that you can turn to your friends as a way of exploring ideas, you know, of really delving into tough questions in a way that will strengthen your friendship. You know, I was friends with a great number of Catholics before I converted. I'm still friends with a number of people who aren't. And in all those cases, as long as we were arguing with the sense of we both love the truth and we want to live in the truth together, exploring those questions made us closer friends. It didn't pull us apart.
I think there's a real maturity and grace that comes with that ability to discuss and to debate even ideas without it being a negative exercise, you know. You obviously have the grace and the intellect to be able to do that well. And I think we can all learn from you in that. And if for the Christians who are listening, obviously we can all take a cue from what you just said to the skeptic. But did you want to add anything with regard to how you would encourage Christians to engage with atheists or non-believers? In a sense, Ben did a beautiful job, I think, in leading you to think more deeply about your own ideas. What would you say to the Christian?
I think it's to be confident that God is working in everyone's life and is calling them by name. You know, and in my case, that calling didn't look like a calling to church for me. It looked like an interest in mathematics. But you know, looking for wherever your friend is ardently pursuing the good, the true, and the beautiful, strengthening that desire, and then really not so much trying to divert them from that, but to say, I have something even more to offer you. You know, I wanted to know what was good and what was true, and I didn't think there was a person behind it. I would have been satisfied with a rule book. And the surprise is that God is always responding to our desires with something bigger and better than what we think we're pursuing when we aren't pursuing Him.
Mm-hmm. That's really wonderful. Well, Leah, thank you again so much for giving of your time and telling us your story. I know that there are some ways that when people are listening, they'll want to know more or hear more about you. And we will include some of those contact points in our episode notes. If you want to add something here, you're more than welcome.
Yeah, you know, so after I converted, had that conversion of the intellect, I did write a book, Arriving at Amen, that's more about the conversion of heart that followed, of learning to pray, learning to think with God instead of just to think about God. Mm. And then a little while after that, I've written a second book called Building the Benedict Option. And that's about building deeper Christian community wherever you are, you know, something you can do in the next 4 to 6 weeks, not something that has to wait for everything in your life to be settled.
Mm. Those sound like wonderful resources, and we will definitely include those in the episode notes as well as any websites or connections with you. Thank you again, Leah, for coming on. It's been a true blessing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into Side B Stories to hear Leah's story. You can find out more about Leah by visiting her website at www.leahlabresco.com. We'll include this website along with her books in our episode notes. For questions and feedback about this episode, you can reach me by email at info@sidebstories.com. I hope you enjoyed it, that you'll rate, subscribe, and share this podcast with your friends and social network. In the meantime, I'll be looking forward to seeing you next time, where another skeptic will flip the record of their life.